You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 11th, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hi there.
And Jay Novella.
Good evening, everybody.
How is everyone tonight?
Great.
Good.
How
are
you doing, Steve?
Tired.
Good.
Tired.
What are you tired about, Bob?
Some residue from the weekend.
Residue.
The Halloween haunt, the corn maze.
Yeah, those 15-hour days are killing me.
But it's fun.
The haunt is going well.
Yeah, we did great. We did 1,200 people last weekend, which is good. For an opening weekend and for a haunt in early October. I hope. Cross your fingers.
Well, that's a little superstitious for us.
Right. But by the time this podcast gets up, it will have been Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
We're, of course, recording a couple of days beforehand.
Yeah.
And, of course, I love these really long Greek phobia words. Periskevidekatriaphobia, the fear of Friday the 13th.
You handled that word like a champ, Steve.
Yeah, thank you.
Bob, what's the fear of the number 13?
Triskaidekaphobia,
yeah.
Yeah, that's a little bit easier off the tongue.
Yeah, this one was definitely a little trickier. It took me a few tries.
Yeah, periskevidekatriaphobia. We will be interviewing later in the podcast Stuart Weiss, who wrote the book Magical Thinking and the Psychology of Superstition, just to talk about superstition on Friday the 13th. This is usually the day that a lot of skeptical organizations have superstition parties, basically, just to celebrate their non-superstitiousness in Friday the 13th. We did one of those a few years ago. It was all right. I know you guys have heard that the Earth is yet again to be destroyed by a comet hitting the Earth.
I heard it's traveling at top speed.
At top speed. Don't get technical with me.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Russian astronomer Nikolai Fedorovsky says that there is a giant comet flying at top speed.
Top speed.
It's bound for the Earth.
Top speed. So it's going. It's coming at the speed of light. Then how do we know it's coming?
Yeah. Exactly.
He says it should hit the planet Earth in late October, so we got a couple more weeks to go.
Oh, like on Halloween, maybe?
Before Halloween?
Yeah, that's unfortunate timing.
That stinks.
Steve, this guy couldn't give an exact date and time, even though he knows its trajectory and speed?
Well, he says we need more astronomers to join forces, and then we could more accurately calculate its trajectory and time of impact.
I don't think that's true. It's not a matter of the amount of astronomers. It's just the time. The longer you observe its orbit, the more accurate you can get. It's not a matter of getting 20 guys on the problem.
Look, we don't have time. It's moving at top speed. Okay?
Come on,
Bob. Pay attention.
Okay. You might be able to squeak in a couple of more haunted corn maze nights, and that's it, man. We're all done.
I just hope the world still exists by, like, next week, because it's my birthday.
That's right.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
The goddess ages.
Here come the birthday emails.
I'd better get some birthday emails, and of course, presents are always accepted. You can send them along.
You can send them via me. I will pre-screen them to make sure nothing weird is going on.
Uh-huh, sure.
So Nikolai says in his Pravda interview, because Pravda so far has been the only major news outlet to break this story.
I'm shocked.
He says, I'm not trying to scare anybody. I just want to warn the public that there's going to be devastating tsunamis, earthquakes, avalanches. But he's not trying to scare anybody, though.
I just want you to know you're all going to die. Don't panic.
No need to panic.
All right, Steve, let's quickly analyze this one. If this was legit, what would be happening right now?
Astronomers, or the world around, would be calculating its orbit, and we would be getting rapid updates as to the trajectory of this body.
And the fact that this is just some obscure news item on Google means that he's totally full of it.
Hey, not on Google. It's on Pravda, possibly the most ironically named paper in the world.
Yeah, it doesn't have much weight, this story. You know, hopefully someone else will just look at this guy's data, you know, try to see if he can see the comet, do some calculations, see if there's any legitimacy to it. Not that it's impossible that we would be hit by a comet. You know, we've been hit by comets before. We'll be hit by them again. But the lack of response by the scientific, especially the astronomical community on this one, to me, says that there's probably not much there.
Imagine if it was confirmed. Imagine the chaos. Yes, in 3 weeks, we will be hit by a comet.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean the end of civilization. I mean, you know, the Tunguska event was probably, you know, a comet of some size. It could be something similar right. to that.
Yeah, but until we actually can pin down, you know, what continent and then what part of that continent, it would, you know, be people would be pretty anxious, I would think.
Where is it going to hit and exactly when?
And I believe that comets generally have much higher top speed than, say your run-of-the-mill asteroid that would hit us. And I remember reading about how they, at least maybe comets that come from our Oort cloud, would just come barreling in very fast and we'd have very little time to react. It's not like we'd have, oh, there's a comet, we've got 10 years, like you can with an asteroid. With a comet like that, I think it would be very difficult to see until it was relatively close.
Yeah, if it were a newly discovered comet, unless it was hitting us on its way out, you know, it may be that we could see it on its way in, then it swings around the sun and it's going to hit us on the way out. Then we would have more warning. If it's right. hitting us on the way in before it really gets close enough to the sun to throw off much of a tail, and it's coming in really fast, we may have little warning.
And even if it was going to hit and we had a month, there's nothing we could possibly do.
That'd be the best month ever, though. Can you imagine?
It would not be boring, that's for sure.
All the cake I'd be able to eat.
even if it was like a year away, I don't think we're at any point where we could quickly put something together and try one of the theories that people talk about, deflecting them, blowing them up, and one of the more interesting ones, and I think we actually mentioned it on the podcast, was actually parking a big object, like a big ship or something, next to the object, and let the gravitational pull of that object actually change its orbit just enough to make it miss the Earth. Of course, it has to be very far away for that to work. Nothing like that would work because I don't think we're taking things like that seriously.
I also heard a theory of sending Bruce Willis to it and having him detonate.
Yeah, he'll take care of it. Send Bruce up there.
Yeah.
There you go. In a space shuttle, too.
With some oil drillers.
Ben Affleck. Yeah. I think
so you're basically saying send a bunch of bad actors up there. They'll fix the problem.
And we'll all be better off even if they don't do it, you know?
It won't save us, but at least we'll be rid of them. But if we're going to do that, I mean, we should set up Tom Cruise, right?
Yeah.
I actually like Bruce Willis, but we should set up Cruise and Travolta.
I want Tom Cruise taped to the front of the ship. So
now look what you've done, Steve. Now you've started Jay on his Tom Cruise hatred.
So we got some good news out of Michigan this week. The State Board of Education on Tuesday approved public school curriculum guidelines that basically support the teaching of evolution but not intelligent design. So that was the decision Woo-hoo. That we were, quote-unquote, hoping for.
Go
Somebody
Michigan.
Pinch me.
So the board made their intent very clear, that evolution is not – this is the quote John Austin, who is an Ann Arbor Democrat and a board member, said, the intent of the board needs to be very clear. Evolution is not under stress. It is not untested science.
That's the bottom line right there.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly
right
correct.
And on that topic, Steve, Evan, and I were just last night listening to Michael Shermer, who was on our podcast last week, talking about his new book, Why Darwin Matters. And he's still on the East Coast. You can check out his tour schedule on the Skeptic website, I think. Definitely check it out if you can.
Excellent lecture.
Very good lecture. Great book. And it really helps dissect the whole problem with intelligent design and evolution.
So it's good to get some occasional good news on the evolution ID front. And I had said after the Dover decision, I think that we're going to see some ripple effect from that. I think that there will be some temporary good news until the creationists find their feet again and their next strategy. I think ID is dead, basically. I think the Dover decision was so definitive that it basically killed ID as a strategy. I think where they're going to head next is just, teach the criticism. Teach the controversy is what was the ID thing. They're going to say just teach the criticism of evolution.
Oh, yeah.
So they're not going to give them anything positive to teach, like ID, just teach the negative things about why evolution is wrong, which is all they care about anyway. ID isn't a real theory. It's not like they care about it. They only really care about about knocking evolution off its perch. So they're just going to cut to the chase with that, which it will be harder to challenge that legally because they're not promoting anything that's not scientific or that's pseudoscientific. They're just saying something which is really just unnecessary. It's not wrong. It's just unnecessary to single out evolution to say that we need to teach the scientific criticism of this theory. That's part of science.
And I think eventually that will fail as well, because people will, I think, hopefully, people will realize that, wait, if you could start knocking evolution, then you could start knocking, you know, Big Bang theory, gravity.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, you can go to town on any theory.
Next thing you know, they're going to be in court arguing against gravity, holding a bunch of helium balloons and saying, see? Explain that.
You might be giving them too much credit.
So. I think I might be giving them too many ideas. They're writing this down furiously. Helium, why didn't we think of that?
There's some similar related news. This one out of the UK. In terms of teaching science in the United Kingdom. The new GCSE, which Bob informs me stands for the General Certificate of Secondary Education, which I guess is the official education credentialing or body in Great Britain, has a new science curriculum, and it's been getting some criticism from scientists and others. Sir Richard Sykes, who's the rector of Imperial College of London, is among the scientists who are attacking the new science standards, essentially saying that it is a dumbed-down syllabus, to quote him. And he says, in recent years, most pupils have studied a combined science. So basically, rather than breaking out biology, physics, chemistry, they teach scientific literacy in the 21st century, which sort of combines, you know, multiple disciplines. It's an interesting approach, actually. And so they basically teach science by focusing on things that are topics in the news today, like global warming, and cell phones were mentioned specifically for some reason. But the critics say that it's not going to prepare them for secondary education, you know, for later education, rather, for higher education, that they, in order to be competitive, you know, you need real A-level courses in the individual sciences, which is probably true. And the other criticism is that, you know, they're teaching about topics that are sort of current and controversial, and it's difficult to teach, you know, the process of science when you're dealing with topics that are currently sort of embroiled in political controversy, which I guess could really work both ways. I think if it were done correctly, it could actually be a good way to sort of illustrate how science is supposed to work and to teach how it can be distorted for political ends. But I think in practice, the difficulty would be making sure that, you know, that basically every teacher who follows that curriculum is not just teaching their own personal political view. You know, and that's what the critics fear. It's interesting. I mean, I think it's we talk about science education a lot on the show, which is why this you know, article caught my attention. And I think it's certainly interesting to experiment with new ways to teach science. And I think they're on to some interesting ideas here, but the implementation really would be everything. And I also think that this kind of thing should probably be in addition to the primary sciences, not instead of. I think that's a critical thing. I think you still need to teach physics, biology, and chemistry, but if you then try to tie it all together with something like how to apply science in the real world or in everyday life or confronting the big issues of the 21st century, that could be a really good course. Well, let's go on to your emails. First, a couple of corrections. The first, I think it's unfortunate that Perry is not with us this week. This first one deals with Perry's news item from a couple weeks ago. This one comes from Joe Walsh, who writes, "Just a comment on the show from 2 weeks ago about the loris in the pants. Not to be pedantic, but I want the Skeptic's Guide to maintain its biology street cred."
We love pedants.
We do. We do. "Perry, a loris is not a monkey, but belongs in the prosimian group or clade, along with the lemurs, podos, and bush babies. A clade is an evolutionary branch which includes all members of that branch and only members of that branch. The term monkeys is an artificial grouping, not a clade, usually referring to New World monkeys and Old World monkeys as a group and excluding the apes. The technical term is that the term monkeys represents a paraphyletic grouping. Rebecca might respond that using the example of a loris versus a bird of paradise would be phylogenetically like pitting a chimpanzee versus a Komodo dragon. I'm not betting against the monkey there. The loris shares a relatively recent common ancestor with the other primates, including chimps, just as the Komodo dragon shares a relatively recent ancestor with the birds."
Relatively recent?
Yeah, I could quibble about that. He says, "Keep up the good work. Love the show."
So basically, this is a big slam on Perry, correct?
Well, no, it's not a slam.
It's a subtle slam.
Oh, no,
merely
I welcome
pointing out that,
I welcome
that Perry's argument was fallacious because he was, you know, trying to argue for monkey superiority, but his example didn't actually include a monkey.
Well, to be honest, yeah. Perry was trying to use a thinly disguised excuse to say the line, "I have monkeys in my pants."
Which was worth it.
I mean, I got to admit, if I saw that line, "I have monkeys in my pants," I would have worked it into the show somehow.
Right.
And Perry worked that in quite
well.
Hell,
I work that into my everyday conversation whenever I can.
But it is true. I did look it up just to make sure that the loris monkey, the monkey is actually a misnomer. It actually is a prosimian. He also brings up the whole clade thing. Now, cladistics is, and this is interesting because in light of the recent conversations we had about classifying planets, because it gets to the question of how should we classify living things in biology. And the debate now is, should we stick with the more classic Linnaean system or should we replace it with the cladistic system? The Linnaean system is not strictly evolutionary, so it breaks things up into groups based upon how they look. Whereas cladistics breaks things up into groups based purely on their evolutionary relationships. So there's a certain purity and a certain modernity to the cladistic approach, but it results in certain things that just are aesthetically unpleasing. For example, humans and chimps would be in the same clade, separate from other apes, from gorillas and orangutans.
What's wrong with that?
And the lungfish would be in a clade with mammals, and separate from other fish. Well, yeah, I mean, it's really, it does come down to, I mean, I remember that Stephen Jay Gould did not like the whole notion of cladistics.
Really?
Yeah, because he said that sometimes animals change so much that they hit upon some new strategy of living, whatever, that produces so much morphological change that they deserve their own designation. And that needs to be recognized. Like, humans are, we're hominids. You know, and being a hominid is different than the non-hominid apes, and that buys us our own categorization. Even though evolutionarily we're on the same branch with chimpanzees,
but how does cladistics determine that? I mean, what's the cutoff? There's still some arbitrariness to it, isn't there?
It's pure evolutionary branching. You know, it's fuzzy in that all species are fuzzy, but that's something that's equal to both systems. The other example would be birds, which he brings up. I mean, birds would be in a subgroup of dinosaurs, not a class equal to mammals and reptiles, right? Birds would just be a little sub-branch of dinosaurs, not their own class.
See why cladistics necessarily has to group it that way. Why couldn't
that,
they?
That's how it works. That's
how
it
works.
Yeah,
but it seems like you're picking just any amount of branches to group together. Like, how do you decide how many branches and how far back, how big to make your clade? Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. I think that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but that's a separate question. You're talking about, like, how many branchings do you include in some kind of a meta category, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we're going to give a name
right.
to...
Yeah,
to,
and then, like, the...
To this branch and all of its sub-branchings. But the difference between this, it's not just a matter of that. It's not just a matter of where you draw your lines. It's also a matter of, you know, how you position them. So no matter where you draw the lines, birds evolved from dinosaurs, and in a cladistic system... the birds would have to be a subgroup of dinosaurs.
Right.
Right? No matter where you draw your lines. And Gould and others have argued that birds are different enough from reptiles that they deserve to be their own class. And cladistics does not allow for the degree of change, only the relationships.
Obviously, Gould was some dirty kind of bird lover then. Too bad Perry's not here to say that.
There's no right or wrong answer. It's just... You make choices about what things matter more. You know, is it what's more important, to have a strictly evolutionary categorization or to have one that reflects the degree of morphological and biological differences? And it's a trade-off. And you can't have it both ways because evolution is messy, you know. Just like same thing with planets. The formation of the solar system was too complex to have really clean categories about what's a planet and what's a dwarf and what's a planetoid and what's a moon. So you just do the best you can and you make your choices. But all choices have strong points and weak points.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about it, if you could somehow magically have the complete, you know, the complete tree of life, of everything, and that's how it would be structured. You would have dinosaurs, and then you'd have an off branch. You'd have the birds, and that's how they evolved. That's the relationship.
Yep.
Regardless of how much the end product changed morphologically, that would be useful if you could.
Of course.
I don't know. I'd go with cladistic.
Well, Bob, it's just, you know what the thing is. I think they're both useful. I think tracking them both ways, depending on how you need to use the data.
And that's basically what's happening now, that both systems are coexisting based upon you know, sometimes personal choice and other times context and how they're being used. Certainly having an exquisitely drawn evolutionary tree is of value, and that's always going to exist and be something that evolutionary biologists are going to work on regardless of the labeling system we choose to label species. But there is also a certain utility to the Linnaean system in terms of recognizing, you know, separate groups that deserve to be recognized.
Plus, so, the Linnaean system has the great mnemonic, you know, King Philip came over for really good sex. Is that what it was?
Is that right?
Well, I never heard that mnemonic.
You know, Bob, I'm working on my own system, which is which animal can kick which other animal's ass.
Yeah, the throwdown system.
The throwdown system.
But isn't it sad, Jay, isn't it sad to be at the bottom of your own system?
Oh, nice.
Well, there's one other quick correction. This one, actually, I pulled this one off the message boards. This one comes from Gil Nye, who's on our message boards, and he wrote, "As the self-appointed resident Brazil specialist, I must correct what was said in the latest podcast about the girl who cried pieces of glass. She absolutely wasn't Brazilian. She wasn't even South American. With a little Googling, I found out her name, Hasna Mohammed Meselmani, and her nationality, she was Lebanese, and the case took place in 1996. And he's correct. Again, I did, you know, went to the original article that I was referring to, and it was an article about Joe Nichols' investigation of this girl's claims about crying pieces of glass. And the reason why I said Brazil was because the story was broken on Brazilian television. So it was a news item in Brazil on Brazilian television. But she was, the girl was Lebanese. I don't know if she was in Brazil at the time or whatever, but that's where Brazil came in. But thanks for the correction. Question number two comes from John Giltner, who writes, "My children were taught in science that the amount of water on the earth is a constant and has been forever. It may change from being frozen, vapor in the form of clouds, or deep underground, but there's always the same amount of water. I wondered when my kids informed me of this, and now I'm wondering again because my mother was at an ecology lecture where she was told the same, and it amazed her so that she had to share it with me. My question, I believe that water vapor is a byproduct of certain combustions, like when hydrogen is burned as a fuel. Isn't this causing a chemical reaction to create water molecules where before there were only hydrogen and oxygen? On the other side of the question, I believe I have heard of separating the hydrogen and oxygen atoms of water molecules to obtain oxygen." So basically he's asking, are the ecologists giving us bad information? And the short answer is yes. Anyone who's claiming that the amount of water on the earth is exactly the same.
Right.
And some even go as far as to say that the water molecules that are on the earth today have always been here, and it's just going through this endless water cycle, but the molecules never change. That's just nonsense. I mean, water is being made and destroyed all the time.
Right. And when he talks about the amount being a constant, what about comets?
Exactly.
I mean, we were inundated with comets at some point in our early
all the time. Water is falling to the earth all the time.
But it's also evaporating off, too. We're losing atmosphere all the time.
That's true. And also, water is getting subducted. It's getting dragged down into the mantle because of subduction. So you have to, so water is falling to the earth. It's being dragged underneath the earth.
It's been chemically changed.
Plants use sunlight to make energy, and guess what? They use up water too. And, water is made and destroyed in the life cycles of plants and animals.
Steve, when water goes down into the mantle, does it ever come back out? In other words, when a volcano erupts, is there moisture in there as well?
Definitely when volcanoes erupt, one of the things that come out is water vapor. But that's a good question, and I don't know that there's a final answer to that. In fact, I read about a year ago a geologist had tried to calculate all of the additions and subtractions of water that are occurring on the earth basically because of this, the subduction process. Came up with, I can't remember the exact date, but it was something to the effect that in 100 million years, something that order of magnitude, that all the earth's water would be gone. That we're basically losing water at a steady rate. And I hadn't heard any follow-up to that. Yeah, maybe I could try to get some follow-up on that and see what the community had to say about that. So I don't know that we know fully.
That's kind of scary.
Yeah, what the net effect of all of the changes in water are on the Earth.
What if we were running out of water? Would we be able to manufacture it?
Theoretically, we could, because all you just need is hydrogen. Right. There's no free hydrogen on the Earth, but you can get hydrogen from lots of other stuff. And you need oxygen, and we kind of need oxygen, you know. Yeah. So we wouldn't want to suck all the oxygen out of our atmosphere just to make water. But what actually, I've read a couple of science fiction books, actually, that talk about, like, how would you get massive amounts of water onto a planet? Like, say, let's say we want to terraform Mars to make it habitable one
day. Hit it with comets.
Yeah, you could steer comets onto the planet, and then the comets would, each comet impact would add a certain amount of water to it, and you do that enough, and you get, and it starts to add up. It'd be trickier doing that to the Earth, you know, because we have to be pretty precise about where we cause the comets to land.
I read an article that they came up with a process to, I think, get oxygen and water out of moon rock.
Mm. That's right. You can suck some water out of moon rock. Not a lot, but any amount of water actually might have implications for, you know, just logistically in terms of, like, flying to the moon and using the moon as a base. If you can get some water, that you don't have to bring 100% of your water to the moon. Speaking about the moon, we got another email dealing specifically with that. This one comes from Scott Breitbach, who obligingly told me how to pronounce his name. And Scott
Smart
wrote,
man.
Yeah, it's good that he did.
I'm just flabbergasted, and here's why. And he gives a URL. Here's a link to the folks who are selling land on the moon. Can this really be done? Can anybody really own the moon? Or is it just some fun conversation piece to share with friends and nobody actually owns part of the moon? Well, I think it's neither legitimate nor fun. I think it's a ripoff is what it is. Basically, in 1980, an American called Dennis Hope filed a petition of ownership to some countries in the UN and said, by the way, I own the moon, Mars, all the planets and all the moons in the solar system, okay? And nobody responded to him because he's a nut job. And he basically took the lack of response as, okay, so no one objects, therefore I own the moon and everything in the solar system. Okay, it's settled. Now, he sold the rights to the moon to this company, Moon Estates, and they're selling off pieces of the moon. It's totally bogus. They don't own the moon. There's no legitimacy to this whatsoever. It's you know, you could think about it in a benign way that it's, oh, you know, you're paying for a piece of paper that says you own a piece of the moon. So some people might do it realizing that they're just paying for the idea, the piece of paper. But it's still, I mean, their website is as if it's serious, which I think is unethical in my opinion. It reminded me also of the International Star Registry. You guys heard about this?
I hate those bastards.
Oh, yeah. So these guys, they do the same thing. They basically, in my opinion, this has, you know, all the earmarks of an actual deliberate scam. There's nothing innocent or whimsical about this. They say, you know, you can name a star, you know, and it will be registered with the International Star Registry, which is nothing. It's just somebody who made it up.
Yeah,
they just made it up. It's not official by anything.
It sounds official.
It just sounds official, right? You know, we could make it up tomorrow. We can come up with the, you know, the Intergalactic Star Registry and start writing people's names in a book and attaching them to some star somewhere.
You can buy a droplet of the Atlantic Ocean. I'm going to sell you.
Right. And then I think they also, what they registered it with the Library of Congress, you know. But again, that's anybody can do that. You can register anything with the Library of Congress. It's just, again, the ways of producing fake legitimacy. You
like
know?
Getting a patent. They'll take just about anybody.
Fake.
But, you know, I think the moon thing is definitely a lot more presumptuous than naming a star, because there's virtually, you know, I wouldn't want to say infinite, but there's pretty much, according to the way humans think, there's an infinite number of stars out there.
Well,
no?
Actually, I think it's closer to 66 trillion, but go ahead.
It's all not right. Infinite. The known universe is finite, but it's a pretty big number.
You know what I'm talking about.
Billions. In other words, and billions.
Everybody can own a billion freaking stars and name it whatever they want before we'd even come close to running out. But the point is,
right,
that, you know, the name a star thing, that's kind of romantic. You give it to a girl, you give it to your boyfriend, you know, it just shows, it's a sign of affection or whatever, it's cute. This selling the moon property, I mean, humans are going to be on the moon within our lifetime. And it really comes down to, like, how are you going to enforce it? Let's say the U.S. government right. or the Soviet Union goes up and they start building structures on the moon that so just by coincidence happens to be on some of your property. What are you going to do about it,
You
Pat?
Go up there with a shotgun.
Yeah. You get off my land, you know?
Exactly.
Give it up. Come on.
I thought about that. Is anyone actually going to press a claim to owning a piece of the moon based upon, you know, their piece of paper from this bogus company?
Yeah, no.
I'm sure it would be dismissed out of hand because there's just nothing legally to it.
Yeah, but you're not hurting anyone by doing that. You know, that's to me, that's really just a fun thing. I don't know. Do people really take it seriously?
It's really not, though, because they...
But some people do it and they think it's legit. They think it's being registered with something official, you know.
Do they think that someday humans are going to live around a star named Frankie, you know?
No, but they go to the observatories and they say, oh, can you show me my star? And the astronomers there are just like, what the hell? That's not your star. And, you know, there's not even a star at the coordinates, you know? And it's just like... It's
we need to get Phil in on this. Phil has to tell us what time
Phil
it is.
Will give you the full breakdown. He hates these guys.
Yeah, he's written about it. He's very critical of it. Yeah, we're talking about Phil Plait, by the way, the bad astronomer.
Jay, I was wrong. I was wrong. There's not 60 sextillion stars. 70. My notes tell me here. There's 70.
Oh, you see? There's even more. All closer to infinity.
7 with 22 zeros after it.
Is that all?
Yeah, that's it.
That's in the known universe, Bob. I'm talking the multiverse, baby.
Multiverse.
Don't start.
Well, we have a name that logical fallacy this week. This one... actually was posted on the website, on our forums, by Manny G. This one comes from the Creation Science Museum of Canada. It's a bit long, but I'm going to read a couple pieces of it. This one is about intelligent design, and on the site they have little models of, like, flagellum, and they write, many types of bacteria swim through water by spinning a rubber-like tail called a flagellum. Because it's rubber-like, and because its semi-solid hook holds it at an angle, the flagellum takes on a corkscrew shape, acting like a propeller in the water. This is like you being able to spin your head around and around and around. So how does it do it? Scientists are pushing the limits of modern technology to be able to dissect these bacteria to see just how on earth they spin their tails. It turns out that the bacteria has something that is just like an electric motor built inside of itself. It goes on to say, when we look inside of a bacterial flagellum, we see a stator, a rotor, and a drive shaft, the bushing or bearings. But what of the bacterial motor? It is no different than the electric motor. How could it have evolved? If any one of these parts isn't quite evolved, the whole system breaks down. Our bacteria can't get around and it dies. If any one of those parts suffers a change in its attempt to evolve, it no longer does its original job. The whole motor fails. The bacteria dies. In modern times, we think something is a superior technology if it's smaller, faster, more efficient. Well, this motor is so small, 8 million of them can fit in the tip of your hairs. An electric motor cannot reproduce or find its own energy or repair itself. The bacteria can do all of these. Where there is design, there is a designer.
Well, I found tons of false analogies in there. False analogies, you know, this is like being able to spin your head around and around. This is just like an electric motor. It's no different from an electric motor. All just false analogies. The other one that popped out was, of course, how could it have evolved? Argument from ignorance right there. So those are the ones that popped out real quick.
Yeah, and there's a ton more as well.
Like I picked up false dichotomy.
Yeah, either it's it evolved or it was designed, in other words.
Yeah.
What's
the third option?
Well, actually, in that case, I would say that's a false dichotomy because it's not because there are other options, but because it's not a dichotomy.
I thought the false dichotomy would have been either it was designed or it would have died. Like, it wouldn't have been able to evolve.
If it changed, it would die.
Right, yeah. Right.
That's you know, kind of a false dichotomy. In that it's limiting the choices of what could possibly happen. Or it's also there's a lot of false assumptions in there as well that if there was one change to the piece of the motor, the flagellum wouldn't work and it would die. Well, first of all, that's an assumption. But, you know, there are bacteria that don't have flagellum. You know, and bacteria might be able to find some other way of surviving even if its flagellum didn't work. You can't assume that it would die. The reason you can make major changes to some genes without killing the host is because there's duplication. Yeah. You know, so. And that's a major mechanism of evolution is that entire genes get duplicated.
Yeah, got all this redundancy.
Yeah. So now I have two sets of genes for flagellum, so one could do its old job, and this new one can is free to evolve in novel directions and come up with all kinds of new cool stuff. And at the end, I think the what I was alluding to with the it's either designed or
right.
or if it didn't evolve, it looks designed. And actually, you know, Shermer spoke about this too last night, this the idea that, well, it is designed, it's just designed by evolution. And there are others in there as well. I mean, this is there's some they make or imply sort of the argument from personal incredulity. It's like, look how fantastic the flagellum is. It's so tiny and so efficient.
Yeah, it's a marvel of evolution.
Yeah, it's a marvel. How could it possibly have come about? So they also, interestingly, they say they actually break their own analogy here. I mean, they say an electric motor cannot reproduce or find its own energy or repair itself. But the bacteria can do all of these things. That's right. That's why a bacteria can evolve, and an electric motor can't, because bacteria can reproduce and use energy. And
So apparently what you're saying is an electric motor is an inanimate object.
Right.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, so it was funny that they broke their own analogy at the end of their discussion there.
I'm guessing they think that when you build a car, you go to a field and you pluck an engine out of the ground.
Right. Planted in the ground. All right, well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Dr. Stuart Weiss. Stuart, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Weiss is a professor of psychology at Connecticut College, and he is the author of the book Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition, which is published by Oxford University Press, and that came out in 1997, correct?
Correct, that's it.
It's an excellent book, and you've lectured to our group on it before. It's an excellent talk. So why don't you give us a summary of what the psychology of superstition is?
Well, there are a number of reasons why people are superstitious. I think a lot of it comes down to the need for the sense of control, that despite the fact that we have control over lots of things in our everyday lives, there are tons of really important things that happen to us that we can't completely control. And when the stakes are high, like you're interviewing for a job or you have a really big exam, SATs, it's really important that you do well. And despite all the preparation that you may put into it, people feel anxious and are and uncertain. And those are the circumstances in which superstitions are likely to emerge. Of course, you know, you had to learn it somewhere, too. Someone had to introduce you to these things for the most part. And so there's a lot of socialization also that is part of it.
So basically, we want to think that we can control the weather, so we invent these magical things we can do to control the weather.
That's right. And sometimes it seems like it works, you know. We do something, and the thing we're hoping for actually does happen. And so, of course, that just reinforces it.
Why doesn't – you would think that, you know, even rudimentary critical thinking skills would kick in and think, well, you know, just me doing this jig, could that possibly affect the weather? I mean, why did these people just not consider that? It just seems like they're turning down their intelligence meter to make themselves feel better, or are they just – that they just don't think about things like that normally anyway. I mean, why does that happen?
I think it's a combination of all of that. One, they may not really be the kind of people who critically evaluate what they're doing on a regular basis. The second thing is that, you know, I think that what they're interested in, the thing they're anxious about, sort of trumps everything else. That,
yeah.
There are a lot of people who say, I know this is silly, but I, quote, don't want to take a chance. I mean, I love that phrase. But they say, I know it can't really work, but in the rare possibility that it would work, I'd hate to have not done it. And so it's an interesting thing. You see people being both rational and irrational in the same moment, and yet it happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about things like obsessive compulsive personality? Would that obsessive compulsive disorder light is like a light version of that disorder for some of these?
It certainly is similar. I mean, I treat OCD in the book, and I think obsessive compulsive disorder is the closest thing to superstition. However, I think it's kind of far beyond the everyday superstition. You have to remember that there are millions of people who are engaging in these superstitions every day, and I think OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, is a far more intense sort of thing, but it does
right.
look the same, and it has that anxiety aspect to it underneath it. It's a anxiety-based disorder and an attempt to cope with that anxiety through these rituals that they do.
Stuart, don't you think that people do it kind of as a habit as well once they get into it?
Absolutely. No, it is a habit. I mean, there's a lot of learning that is involved, both in terms of learning from other people. I mean, the basic classic superstitions, the only way you can acquire them is if someone teaches them to you. And some of them, I really think it's a crime to teach people. For example, Friday the 13th. I mean, what is the possible upside of learning that Friday the 13th is unlucky? I struggle to come up with that. But there's a lot of learning from other people, but then it also, once you engage in overt behavior of doing these superstitions, then of course it becomes a habit like anything else, and it has a sort of soothing feature to it.
Now, you've wrote about in your book the fact that professional athletes are notoriously into many superstitions.
Right, absolutely.
See it a lot in baseball.
What are some of the common ones?
There are some like, for example, if the pitcher has a no-hitter going, you're not supposed to speak to him when he's in the dugout because you could jinx the no-hitter. So it's a funny thing. The pitcher is doing really well as the game progresses, and then no one's actually talking to him as he's sitting in the dugout. It's an odd circumstance. And rally caps you know of. But there's also, baseball is rife with people who have personal superstitions that are unique to them. I wrote a lot in the book about Wade Boggs eating chicken when he was a player both with the Yankees and the Red Sox. He believed that eating chicken got him hits, and he ate chicken before every single baseball game. And so it's really kind of impossible to know whether chicken gave him hits or not, because he never didn't eat chicken, and so he have nothing to compare it to. But
right.
But it seemed to work to him, and so he did. So there's a lot of that. There's a lot of sort of personal superstitions that players develop, and the circumstances are perfect. You know, it's a very uncertain game, especially hitting in baseball is a very uncertain activity. The best players only hit every third time to the plate. And yet there's a lot at stake. You know, these people are making big money, and the games are important, and so superstitions emerge.
You know, sir, fairly recently, Richard Wiseman did some studies that he thought showed people who feel that they're lucky actually do end up being luckier, and people who feel that they're unlucky end up being unluckier, usually because the lucky people tended to notice opportunities more often and the unlucky people tended to miss opportunities. Have you looked into any results like that?
Well, I've seen his stuff, and I think it's very interesting. I think it's undoubtedly true. I think there's some interpretive things going on there. You know, we're all familiar with the confirmation bias, and if you see yourself as being a lucky person, then you're going to see and remember those instances where you seem to have been lucky more often. But so I think there's something to that, and I do think that. I mean, I hate to say that there's anything good about being superstitious, but I do think that that for the positive superstitions, the ones aimed at bringing about good luck, that they probably do build confidence, and they probably are a way of coping with anxiety for these people. Again, I'm not encouraging anyone to do it, because there are other ways, I'm sure, to cope with that anxiety than to believe in a rabbit's foot or some ritual that you might perform.
Well, it's like the Dumbo effect, right? Like you think something gives you the power, so you just kind of go with that. Speaking as a poker player, I think that I've seen that where somebody has their lucky object and it gives them more confidence and it intimidates other people as well because they kind of buy into it as well. So it's kind of funny the way these things can sort of actually affect real life.
Yeah, so from one point of view, it is confirmation bias. It's just noticing the correlations that you think are supposed to be there. But on the other hand, it can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. In that, you know, again, if you think that you are destined, you know, for happiness and good things to happen to you, you kind of make them happen to you. And if you're a depressed, negative individual, that's going to have a negative impact. I think that reminded me of what psychologists sometimes do, which is the as-if strategy. If you want, you know, your life to be this way, if you want to be this kind of person, then just act as if that's the way it is. So if you want to be a lucky person, just act as if you are lucky. So that's basically the same thing, but, you know, psychologists sort of have a way of conceptualizing it that doesn't include any superstition.
That's right. Sort of a role-playing.
Yeah, it just becomes a role-playing. So I think that's what all this amounts to, is just this self-fulfilling kind of prophecy of having a positive versus a negative attitude. The pitcher dugout, I was going to say about that, that also, I think, brings up the fact that there could be a lot of cultural pressure to adhere to superstitions, because even if you don't buy the whole jinx thing, you don't want to be the player that talks to the pitcher and then have him blow his no-hitter. Even if it's not true, you know everyone else is going to blame you for being the jinx, right?
Absolutely.
So it creates a lot of cultural pressure for that. I mean, do you talk about that?
I'm not sure I covered that actually in the book, but since then I have. And the point that you're making is quite valid. I think that there's a bonding experience, especially for team members. You know, the shared superstition is more than a hope for luck. It is, in fact, a sort of team bonding thing that we do together. We're, you know, and that often the dugout is a place where there's nothing you can do. You know, that, mm-hmm. that you're just sitting there, and there's somebody up to bat that can do something, but you can't. And so this is also a time filler and a way of bonding with the other teammates. So yes, there would be pressure to go along with it, even if you don't believe, just because you don't want to be that player.
Right. And I guess also, if it is a bonding experience, you may do it not because you feel pressure, but just because you want the bonding experience, and because
right.
it's just a ritual of the game and of,
right.
of your shared experience. And even though you know it's there's no, even though you're not engaging in the magical thinking part that goes along with it.
Exactly. You know, one of the other superstitions that I think is similar in this regard is knocking on wood. You know, people rarely, in my experience, knock on wood when they're alone. Right? It's really a cryptic. You know, it's
that's
a, you know,
right.
True. I mean,
yeah.
Think about it.
Very good.
It only happens as a. It's really more a communication of a shared wish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if this happens to me, knock, knock, knock. Right. It's
mm-hmm.
it's you're communicating something about your deep desire for this thing to happen, and it's a very social thing. It's not in fact the same as many superstitions. You know, a lot of these things that people do that are true superstitions that are personal to themselves only, they won't even tell other people about it because they're ashamed of the fact that they're superstitious. There is still a taboo to a degree admitting that you're superstitious. And so these people are less likely to say anything, whereas knocking on wood is something that we all do, you know, well, we all, but I mean, that is done socially and it is meant to be a social thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you think there still is, if anything, a social taboo against believing in superstition that in general people realize or think that it seems silly?
Yeah, I think, if you just ask somebody point blank, are you superstitious? There are some people who will be forthright and say, yes, I am. But I think there are a number of people who would be reluctant to admit it. Or if they do, they say they're just a little bit or
yeah.
something
yeah.
like this. There's an attempt to minimize it. And as a result, I think that a lot of the poll data, the Gallup poll data about how many people are superstitious probably is a somewhat of an underestimate of what the real numbers are.
So are we somewhat hardwired to fall into these superstitious traps?
Well, to a degree, I think that, you know, we are tremendous learners. We do seek relationships and try to problem solve in any circumstance where we're confronted with a problem. And it seems only natural that some of the connections we make are false ones, that they will appear to be real cause and effect relationships when in fact they're not. And yeah, I think we are. I think that our rapid ability to find patterns and create relationships and to acquire new behavior as a result of those creates a situation where superstitions are likely to occur.
Do you buy the conventional wisdom that seems to be emerging that, as you say, that these sort of simplistic heuristics that we evolved were well adapted to maybe the simplistic environment in which we evolved, but they don't really adapt to the complex technological scientific society in which we now find ourselves?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. I think that our environments have probably always been fairly complex, and that I think that this is all speculation anyway. But I think right. I believe that it is just in our nature to sort of over pattern, over analyze the environment, and assert those things that are important.
Well, it's like pareidolia, finding meaningful images in just random. Random shapes, seeing a face in the clouds. It's similar to that. It's just pattern seeking.
Exactly. And we'd prefer to have a pattern than not. It's like rats will, as I'm sure you've heard, rats will press a lever just to find out when the shock is going to come, even though that pressing the lever has no effect on the shock at all. Just to know when it's coming gives that animal a sense of control over the environment, even though it can't stop it. And I think that, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about, where we're looking for any kind of order in the environment that gives us a sense of predictability.
All right, so certain doom is better than uncertainty.
That's right, that's right.
Yeah. I have to say, as a physician, I've experienced that personally, in that I've had patients express directly or in their reactions that they would rather be told they have a horrible diagnosis than to be told that I don't know what they have.
Right.
And sometimes I have to spend some time convincing them that they're actually better off not knowing than knowing they have some horrible diagnosis. But that they're more afraid of the uncertainty.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting. It's very interesting psychology.
It is.
You told me before that you do teach at the college level. You told me that some of your courses are directly involve a lot of the issues, the skeptical issues that we deal with. You give a freshman seminar on psychology and critical thinking. Why don't you
That's
tell
right.
us about that?
We've implemented a system a lot of colleges have of freshman seminars where the freshmen get to have a small class right away. And I thought this would be a great circumstance to get them early and teach them some critical thinking skills and a little bit of psychology at the same time. And so, and one of the things I think is really important for people to learn and isn't being taught enough is the basic fallacies and the sort of the tools for good arguments. And so I use a basic critical thinking textbook for that and work with the students. And sort of the culmination of it is that I have them do a real Oxford-style debate on a topic that they choose. But after they've chosen the topic, they don't know whether they're going to have to take the affirmative or the negative viewpoint. And so they only learn which side of the argument they're going to have to take by flipping a coin. And it's very dramatic, by the way. We do it in class, and the students are there, and they don't know what they're going to do, and we flip the coin, and it happens. And then they have to come in later and do the argument. And it's a very good exercise. I don't think enough college courses or courses in general teach debate as a real skill, as a sort of formal thing, and it's a very useful thing for them to learn.
Yeah, in my experience, almost nobody really knows how to do it anymore. I get into debates almost on a daily basis, even if they're just in writing on email, and most people don't know the first thing about how to actually construct an argument and what legitimate logic is versus logical fallacies. most arguments that especially in the realm that we're dealing with, the paranormal and pseudoscience, they basically amount to just a string of logical fallacies.
And it becomes a very useful tool for them if they can make the transition to actually seeing them in everyday life. It's not easy. It's a skill you have to practice too. But I can't tell you how wonderful the feeling is when in the middle of this hot going debate in the classroom, some kid says, no, you can't say that. That's just a false correlation there or whatever. That you're affirming the consequent. You can't say that. I just beam when I hear that sort of thing. So yeah, it's great.
You could play Name That Logical Fallacy.
That's right. Yeah, so I try to carry through with some of these things in my courses because not enough of it is being done. I also teach Intro Psych, which is a large lecture, and you get lots of fresh young minds there, and I do quite a bit with critical thinking there too. I show them a video on facilitated communication, which mm-hmm. is an excellent example of how important critical thinking is and scientific reasoning.
Right, and just for our listeners, facilitated communication was a movement mainly in the 80s and into the 90s that involved communicating with children or people who were severely mentally handicapped or autistic and could not communicate, and the therapists believed that they could communicate with them by holding their hand or facilitating their hand, and then they would point to letters on a board or keys on a typewriter, and that they could communicate in that fashion. But it turned out that the facilitator was doing all the communicating. They were completely deceiving themselves into doing it.
I believe there's an episode of Law and Order about that for those of you like me who get all your information from television. Just make a note.
Stuart, do you think that superstition is one of the core elements to why religion is so strong with humans?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that people, let's put it this way, I get at it the other way around, which is to say that people who are rational thinkers and who value science are probably likely not to believe in either thing. I would say that superstition and religion can be either friends or not. There are an awful lot of religious people who are quite anti-superstition, and so I think all the combinations are possible. But I would say that if you are a rationalist and someone who values scientific thinking, then you're probably going to be a little bit soft on both those things, on both religion and superstition. But I don't know. I'm not sure. I think that some of the mechanisms are similar. I mean, obviously, people tend to be the same religion as their parents often, and so obviously there's socialization and learning from your parents involved, and that's how you become superstitious too. But beyond that, I don't know what the connection between the two is.
Now, just connecting the logical fallacies with superstition again, I think I remember you speaking about this during your lecture to us, was that the core logical fallacy of superstition is often that A always correlates with B, except when it doesn't. And that is sort of and people express it that way. I always win when I wear my lucky shirt, except when I don't.
Right.
And that of course, that logic enables you to incorporate any data into your superstition. Or I think the flip side of that was to say, this shirt, I always win when I wear this shirt, and then until they lose, they say, oh, now it's flipped. Now it's the unlucky shirt.
Isn't that convenient?
You studied the book very well. That's exactly right. I'm amazed. Yes, there's this sort of wind shift strategy where you the shirt is good until it loses, and then it's terrible. There definitely are people who have that pattern. The other one is also the case that people make exceptions. I did an experiment earlier where several years ago in which students were playing a video game and they had to sort of follow a pattern and find out how they got rewards, how they earned points. It's a very simple video game with a matrix. And they would make up these stories. I mean, the fact is that it was random, that I had a random number generator, and sometimes they would get a point and sometimes they wouldn't. but they would develop these patterns, and in some cases they would develop sequences of patterns. And so one student, for example, said, well, you always get a point if you go this way, except when you don't go get a point, it's because you should have gone that way. You know, so
right.
You're right. There's either sort of an exception-making pattern where you fill in the blank with what you should have done, or you just sort of give up as soon as it ends. So those are both very common.
Yeah, and I remember that. I love that experiment. I remember when you talked about it, and most people fell into that pattern, except for a few who did some controlled experiments and realized that it was random. Isn't that right?
Yeah, they were like the stars. There were only a couple, unfortunately. But they actually, you know, systematically tried certain things. They would hold something constant and do it over and over and over again and see what happened. Then they would shift and hold this constant and do it over. And with real experimentation, they were able to say, hey, you know what? I don't think there's any pattern here. It's just random.
And only a
right.
couple? Only a couple did that?
Only a couple.
Out of how many?
Out of like 20, I think I had two. I mean, it was very
about
rare.
10%. That has become, ever since I heard about that, you doing that experiment, that has become my example to represent this notion that basically you will fall into this sort of self-deceptive pattern of confirmation bias and pattern seeking unless you specifically impose some scientific methodology on how you think about and how you approach the data. So it's basically like a microcosm for why we need science, you know,
right.
Absolutely. Sense of the world.
That's true.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and it's not something that everybody's going to know how to do. I mean, I felt that these students who did it had some skill, had learned somehow that I need to do this strategy in order to test the hypothesis, and I don't think that that's being taught enough.
That's right. I unfortunately agree with you on that. Well, Stuart, it was wonderful having you on. We appreciate you spending some time with us.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Happy Friday the 13th.
Yeah, be safe on Friday the 13th.
I'll try.
Yeah, Stuart, I wish you good luck on the sale of the book, but I don't want to insult you.
That's okay.
Is there going to be a newer edition coming out sometime?
I hope so, yeah. I would like to do a revised edition.
Yeah, well, definitely keep us updated if you do. We'll get you back on.
Will do, thanks.
All right, take care.
Thanks, Stuart.
Thanks.
And now, Randy Speaks.
Hello, this is James Randy. Some of our listeners have sent in ideas as to subjects I might address, and Karen in Melbourne, Australia, has suggested aromatherapy. Karen and the rest of you folks, aromatherapy is just one of the silliest notions I've ever heard of. What they do is they present you with all kinds of oils and aromas that are, admittedly, quite pleasant. These are distributed by various means, leaving them open in evaporating dishes in your living room or plugging them into the wall so that the room is suffused with cinnamon or garlic or whatever you wish. Now, I can easily forego the garlic, I guess most of us could, but cinnamon is rather attractive to me. It's the claim that's made for aromatherapy that really gets to me, however. It says that this cures diseases and relieves conditions. Well, if you've got a really smelly house, perhaps it does. But let's face the hard facts here. Your olfactory organ, that's your nose in case you didn't know it, is very sensitive. It'll pick up all kinds of good information about the world around us. But it's simply a myth that diseases and medical conditions can be relieved by means of the olfactory glands. Yes, having a nice aroma in the air might help you to a certain extent, might make you feel better, it might make your environment a little pleasanter. That does not imply, it doesn't mean, that any medical cures are on their way. As with most of these things, very simple double-blind tests would determine whether or not there is any medical advantage to be had through aromatherapy. And, as with all of these claims, that sort of test is not involved in the evaluation of such claims. Now, don't ask me how, but I was reminded from Karen's request for something about aromatherapy of something else entirely different. I recall that when I was attending grade school in Toronto, Canada, where I was born and almost raised, there existed a pair of schoolyard bullies who gave all of the kids a very hard time. I pulled a bit of a gag on them that, well, I hope that neither one of them is listening to this, or they might want to seek me out for a certain reprimand, if you know what I mean. These two kids were typical bullies in that they would literally empty the other kids' pockets out, take their lunch money, if there was any there, and anything valuable they had on them. In those days, as today, there was no point in going to teachers or the principal or anybody else around and complaining about it. You had to handle it yourself, and I did. Now, just a wee bit of history. At that time, and I believe still in Canada, there was a type of chewing gum sold that was called Thrills. I don't know why. It wasn't much of a thrill, I can assure you. Thrills were sort of elongated chiclets, and they were a dark lavender in color. These two bullies were quite partial to them, I was told, and that gave me my approach for a really good joke and some revenge. Working with my friend Gary, I found a way that we could get even very easily. We bought a packet of Phenamint, which is a very powerful laxative. I believe it used as active ingredient the chemical phenolphthalein. Believe me, it really worked well. Gary discovered that if you very lightly sanded the surface of the Phenamint chewing gum, which was just about exactly the same size, you could roughen it so that it could be colored. So we mixed together some red and blue drawing ink to closely approximate the color of the Thrills chewing gum, then used ordinary paraffin to polish up the surface of these chiclet-like confections. Sure enough, arriving at the schoolyard very early one morning, the two bullies spotted us, went into my pockets, and found this package of, apparently, Thrills chewing gum. They split the entire box between the two of them and had a huge wad of gum in their mouths that they were chewing away on very happily. Lo and behold, just before school let out that day, the two bullies had to ask to be excused. I won't get into the details, but one of them didn't make it down the hall. This is James Randi. See you next week.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or fact. Two facts. Two are genuine, one is fictitious. Then I challenge my esteemed panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme for this week. The theme is robots and computers. I know you love themes.
I love robots.
I said
yeah,
it first.
So do I. Robots are awesome.
Okay, let's stop right now. Them. Who has a robot on their desk right now?
Me.
I know I do.
I have the robot devil on my desk.
Ooh, that sounds interesting.
I have one on my kitchen floor.
A robot devil?
No, a roboraptor. All right, you guys ready? Number one, research indicates that brief internet counseling is effective in the treatment of depression, as effective as traditional psychotherapies. Number two, this one is the robot gardener. A robot designed at the University of Illinois will move up and down the rows of a crop field, recognize weeds by sight, and then cut and spray them. And item number three, Sony has just announced plans to release a new version of their popular PlayStation that they claim can be played hands-free with the use of the mind alone. Bob, why don't you go first?
Let's see, robot crop detector, that sounds very likely to me with the pattern recognition. It's getting fairly advanced. I mean, there's certain numbers of weeds that you're looking for and certain shapes, so that's that sounds very likely. Brief internet counseling is effective compared to psychotherapy.
Traditional psychotherapies, yep.
I'm going to say that's true as well, mainly because three just doesn't do it for me. Sony PlayStation, they've got a hand. They're using the whole mind thing to do PlayStation. I mean, they could. It's been in the news a lot where you hook it up to your thoughts, and depending on your, I guess, you know, the way, you know, your brain patterns, you can move a cursor up and down. They're not, I don't think anyone's doing anything really complicated yet with that, which is what you would require for PlayStation. And people would not like to train themselves to actually just move a stupid Pong thing up and down. They wouldn't enjoy that. So I would say that's Baloney.
Alrighty, Rebecca?
I agree in that that sounds completely ridiculous, but that's why I'm going to say it's probably true, because it just sounds so stupid that it's probably true. So I'm going to go with the, I'm going to go with number two.
The robot gardener? The
gardening thing, yeah.
Okay.
That sounds fishy.
Alrighty, Jay?
Oh, I'm playing PlayStation with my mind right now. One second. The last I read, the PlayStation, I think it was, they can do it by tracking your eyes. So I don't think the mind reading one is either you're being unclear or whatever. But I don't believe that.
Right, hands free is getting popular, but not not using the mind, not yet. I guess.
So you think that one's fake as well? So you all agree.
Yes, I do.
That internet counseling is effective as traditional psychotherapies in treating depression. And that one is science. That one is true. Internet of long-term benefit for depression. This was research done at the Australian National University, and they found that brief internet-based interventions for depression are immediately effective and have significant positive long-term benefit that may be as effective as active psychotherapies. The finds are yet to be published as we're recording this, but the studies were done by Professors Helen Christensen and Andrew McKinnon and Dr. Kathy Griffiths at the Center for Mental Health Research. So that's neat because obviously internet counseling would be certainly convenient and cost effective. And so that would be another option to have. And also the fact that that a brief intervention could have some long lasting effects is also a good thing. One of the downsides of therapy is that it takes a long time. So the interesting thing about that, and the reason why this was maybe a little counterintuitive to counselors or the medical profession, is that there seemed to be a benefit to the physical closeness, that being physically present with somebody had an important therapeutic role. So, the question is, what does this really say about the psychology and the socialization of the internet? More and more people are connecting over the internet. Perry met his wife over the internet. And that's not an uncommon story these days. And maybe human connectedness doesn't need the real physical closeness. Maybe the virtual contacts that we make over the internet are just as emotionally impactful to us as more physical connections. So that's interesting.
That is interesting.
Rebecca, you thought that the robot gardener was bogus.
Yeah.
That one is also science. That one is true.
Damn.
This is a solar robot, which uses a system of uses 20/20 vision, and it goes on a search and destroy mission for weeds. The purpose of this is to reduce the use of herbicide. It's still actually spraying the weed, so it cuts it and then sprays the stump. But by spraying a small amount directly on the plant, that uses up much less herbicide, and its distribution is much more controlled than if you had to spray an entire field.
Yeah, some herbicides are can be very expensive, so that saves tons of money.
Yes, and some of that's true.
How expensive are weed-killing robots, though? I mean, that's got to be kind of pricey.
Well, after 30 years, you make your money back, and,
Well, I'm sure if it goes into wider spread use, it could be cost-effective.
Yeah, absolutely.
It uses a GPS for navigation. It has two small cameras, so it has depth perception. This was engineered by Lee Tian, an agricultural engineer at the University of Illinois. He wrote, if he sees a weed, he can actually tell how far away it is, which I guess would be helpful in going up to it. Agriculture is big business. I'm sure the cost effectiveness of this will be worked out. The third item about Sony PlayStation using just the mind is fiction. That one I made up. But this is based on a real news item that I wanted to touch on. This one, teenager moves video icons just by imagination. So this was the first playing of a video game with the mind alone, although this is not yet ready for the Sony PlayStation yet. Just as a 14-year-old who suffers from epilepsy and has some physical impairment is the first one to play a video game with his mind alone. He's basically playing a Space Invaders-like game. Because Space Invaders, you basically have to move the ship back and forth and fire, only using signals from his brain to make the movements. But it did require the implantation of a chip. So it's not like a cap you could put on. that's really the stage that we're going to have to get to before, you know, you get to, you're going to see it in your PlayStation.
So I wonder what exactly did he have to think about to make it move, do you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but there's a number of research, you know, protocols for this, and I don't know what they actually think about. I mean, sometimes...
Is it just enhancing or suppressing, like, alpha waves and beta wave frequencies?
Yeah, but how do you do that consciously?
You could train yourself. You'd be surprised.
It actually... does require the feedback. It's almost at first random, you know, getting it to move. And then when it moves, you say, okay, you know, whatever you were just doing, just keep doing that to get it to move in that same direction. Now, they've also done this to for replaced limbs. So you can actually, like, think about closing your robotic hand and it closes. That's a little bit more straightforward because you're thinking about your hand closing, even though it doesn't have the same sensation of being your arm that you're, you know, a biological arm would have. We don't have the sensory feedback yet. That's another step that we need to get to. But first boy to play a video game with his mind. So this is the first little baby step on our way to being fully immersed in game worlds. We're playing just with our minds.
So Bob and I are wrong then.
No.
No, you're right.
No.
But you get a point taken away just for saying that.
Sure. No, but he just said the kid could. They did it.
But it's not PlayStation.
Yeah, but Jay. It's not a Sony PlayStation coming out next year.
Oh, I thought that maybe Sony did this with him.
No. I made totally up. It was just inspired by this story about the computer chip, you know, in the Space Invaders game.
This is still in the lab. It's not ready for consumers.
Right. Well, that's it for this week, guys. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Always, good episode.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, good one, guys.
We're going to end, as usual, with our skeptical quote. Bob is our quote master, and his choice for this week is the following. Somewhere, something incredible is waiting to be known. And I know you guys all know who said that, because we talked about it before the show. But that was said by the immortal Carl Sagan. In my opinion, the most eloquent scientific skeptic that has ever lived, at least so far. I'm sure his quotes will be cropping up at the end of our shows in the future. So, until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Problems, proof, endless delays.